Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Presidential candidates may have to pay a bit more attention to Washington State voters come 2020. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has more on the effort in Olympia to bump up our presidential primary.
Right now, our presidential primary is held on the fourth Tuesday in May, generally well past the point it can have any relevance because party nominees have been mostly decided by then. In an ongoing push from Secretary of State Kim Wyman, there is now an effort in Olympia to bump that to the second Tuesday in March in time for the 2020 presidential election. It's an effort that has come up in the past couple of sessions, but failed to get by Democrats who don't use the primary to allocate delegates, but instead use the caucus system, which critics argue is archaic and elitist. This time around, there are a couple of different bills in the Senate, one from a Republican, the other from a Democrat. Both would change the date to early March, and both would allow the Secretary of State some wiggle room to change the date of the primary to align with nearby states' primaries and create a sort of West Coast Super Tuesday. Democratic Senator Sam Hunt is behind one version and says on top of moving the date, he hopes the shift brings another change.
To have a primary that the parties will use for selection allocation of delegates to the national and state conventions so that we don't have the mishmash that we have had at political precinct caucuses, so that we have a meaningful primary.
Republican Senator Hans Zeiger is behind the other version.
It will make our state more attractive to candidates to show up here and campaign. That's very important as we set the standard for the rest of the country in a lot of ways. And so our presidential candidates ought to be paying attention to that.
But Zeiger's bill goes further, removing the option for write-in candidates and the more controversial move of allowing unaffiliated primary ballots.
There are a lot of people who are unaffiliated, who don't consider themselves Republicans, don't consider themselves Democrats, who want to vote in a presidential primary, and we should give them that option. And then we should give the option to the political parties to consider.
But David McDonald, who represents the Democratic National Committee for Washington State, says that violates national party rules.
The national party rules on the Democratic side explicitly say the unaffiliated portion of a presidential primary ballot not only should not be used in allocating delegates, but it is considered detrimental.
And he says because it is considered detrimental, candidates and state parties are required to take whatever steps necessary not to participate in that primary.
Most obvious two steps possible are, number one, for the candidates to withdraw their name so there are no Democratic candidates on the ballot, and number two, if somehow or another their name is on the ballot, to not campaign in the state, defeating what I understand to be one of the major purposes of having a primary bill, which is to draw candidate attention.
He says there are also other issues with the Zeiger bill that the Secretary of State wants, including the fact that the system it would use to allow for unaffiliated voters also prohibits a recount, and the fact that it does not allow voters to choose uncommitted delegates.
Uncommitted is a legitimate preference under Democratic Party rules. In 1992, for example, 25% of the state's delegation went to the national convention formally uncommitted. It's an acceptable preference. It's a preference that may well be attractive to unaffiliated voters who choose to vote in the Democratic primary, but who want to send an unaffiliated delegation because the field is so split.
But overall at the hearing, there wasn't much in the way of opposition to the overall idea of moving the primary up earlier, and there did seem to be some willingness to bend on the other issues. Both bills have bipartisan sponsors, and there's also companion bills in the House, though neither of those have hearings yet.
And Hannah joins us live now. So Hannah, holding the primary in March, would that apply to the congressional seats as well?
This would, yeah, everything in the presidential primary.
Wow. So we wouldn't have the August primary that we have now. You would be voting for the congressional field
presidential preference primary.
So in other words, this would not include the congressional candidates.
No, it wouldn't change the August. This is the one we do in late May before presidential elections.
Okay, I got you. Now, the last time, as I recall, at least on the Democratic side, they abided by what the caucuses said, right? Not the primary.
Right. And they would still, so this wouldn't mandate that they have to do what the primary does, but would, the idea is that it would make it more attractive for them to choose to use the primary results. And at this hearing, there was a member of the state Democratic Party who suggested that they might be, though not on that second bill that we just heard from, where it would have allow for that unaffiliated voters option.
Okay, so the primary goal here is to get candidates to visit us in Washington State. And so how the results are used, that's up in the air?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. The state parties would still have that option to either use the caucuses or to use the primaries. But the overall idea here is that this would make it more attractive for them to use the other. The other push here, and I want to point out that the Secretary of State is behind the Republican bill from Hans Zeiger, which allows that unaffiliated voter option. The idea there is that there's a lot of people, she says she gets a lot of complaints from people who feel like because they don't want to identify as Republican or Democrat, that they don't get to take part in the process. Now, her option of allowing that unaffiliated voter option would send one Democratic ballot, one Republican ballot, and then one with just all the candidates in alphabetical order, then those people would feel like they could be part of the process and vote, but it would still just be largely symbolic. They wouldn't be able to, by the time, if you picked a Democrat or Republican candidate, at that point you'd have to declare. So it's a little confusing, and we'll see how that washes out, but I don't think that version has much of a chance.
Here is Hannah Scott. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You find you're having more and more trouble hearing me every morning. Maybe it's hearing loss. Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. We've heard a lot about how young people, especially because they have earbuds in their ears all the time, might be at risk of hearing loss. But there are a lot of reasons you might have trouble with your hearing. So where do we begin here? How do you recognize when you may have a problem that requires going to the doctor?
Hearing loss, it occurs gradually as we age. It's pretty common. About 25% of people in the United States between the age of 55 and 64 actually have some degree of hearing loss. And then in those adults who are 65 years and older, really the number of people who have hearing loss is about 50% or 1 in 2. So aging and then chronic exposure to loud noise or noise-induced hearing loss are the significant factors that really contribute. And there are other factors that are kind of more temporary, things like having excessive earwax, and that can temporarily prevent your ears from conducting sound well. And so that's obviously fixable. You just clean out the ear. The other types of hearing loss, that comes with aging, and that comes from noise, it's something that really is not reversible. And it's something that you're stuck with. So people who have hearing loss develop very specific symptoms. They may have like muffling of speech or other sounds, or most commonly it's recognized because they have difficulty understanding words. And the problem is that when people start to lose their hearing, it creates some social problems. And so they'll often withdraw from conversations or even avoid social settings, and it can lead to depression.
Are there early symptoms which, if you caught them, could prevent that kind of hearing loss?
Age-induced hearing loss, it just happens. And it is, to some degree, genetically predisposed. We can actually do genetic testing to see if you have the likelihood of developing age-induced hearing loss. But that just happens, and there's really no good prevention for it. However, for noise-induced hearing loss, usually it's environments where you're exposed to loud noises that are a problem. For example, you know, if you ride a motorcycle or you work in a place where you use power tools, or you listen to loud music by putting earbuds in your ear and playing music very loud, or if you play in a band or you attend loud concert or things like that, and even things that are related to your work. If you're a gardener and you use a lawnmower or a leaf blower or woodworking tools, things like that, all those things can contribute to noise-induced hearing loss. Sound is measured in units called decibels. We've all heard that word, decibels. And sounds of less than 75 decibels, even after a long exposure, are really unlikely to cause hearing loss, is what most studies show. However, really long or repeated exposure to sounds at or above 85 decibels can cause hearing loss. So to give you some examples of like what sound is, like the humming of a refrigerator is 45 decibels. You and me having a conversation, a normal conversation, is 60 decibels. But when you're sitting in heavy city traffic, that's 85 decibels. So that's really you're there at that limit. If you ride a motorcycle, it's 95 decibels. And when people have these MP3 players in and they're listening to music loud, that's 105 decibels on average.
Wow. Boy, I tell you, when the times I'm walking down the street and a fire truck or ambulance goes by, I put my fingers in my ears because it comes to the threshold of pain. And that's the question. Can a single exposure like that damage those delicate fibers that actually sense the sound?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in fact, that is one of the ways that can happen. If you get exposed to a blast or an explosion or something like that, yeah, it absolutely can cause hearing loss. And it can be either temporary or permanent. People can suffer like 48 hours or so of hearing loss, or it can be permanent hearing loss if they damage their eardrum or damage the little hair cells in their nerve. If you think you're losing your hearing, make sure you get tested. You'll see somebody called an audiologist. And an audiologist is a specialized medical personnel who actually will test your hearing. They'll actually put little tiny tones into your ear in different frequencies and see exactly where it is that you're losing your hearing. Prevention is the key. So if you're at a concert, wear earplugs. If you're somebody who hunts, wear ear mufflers. If you are a yard worker and you're using lawnmowers and blowers, you know, wear ear protection. Anytime you're exposed to loud noise, you need to wear ear protection. And the one that's voluntary that we really need to think about is just how loud do we turn up our MP3 players when we've got the earbuds in our ear.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Sound Transit is headed back to court over the ST3 project and high car tab fees. Car Radio's Hannah Scott says the lawyers behind the class action lawsuit are appealing a lower court's decision to toss their case.
The lawsuit was filed on behalf of a half dozen voters in Pierce, King, and Snohomish counties last year. Joel Ard is the lawyer handling the case.
It's our position that when the legislature drafted the enabling statute for the Sound Transit 3 motor vehicle excise tax, they made quite a mistake in how they put that together, that they amended an existing statute without setting it forth in full and don't fall within any of the accepted guidelines for doing that. So the statute as a whole is unconstitutional.
It's a complicated argument, but the main point Ard makes,
if you're going to change the way the existing law governs people's lives, you have to set that existing law out so that when people read the proposed statute, they know what kind of change you're making. And what they did in this case is there's an existing valuation schedule, and the legislature said in a very sort of tortured and backhanded way, don't use the existing schedule, use one that got repealed 16 years ago. But they don't spell out the contents of the repealed schedule.
So he contends, among other things, that the full text of the old vehicle valuation system should have been included. And because it wasn't, this is in violation of the state constitution. It led to a spectacle of a court hearing in Pierce County in September where Sound Transit lawyers brought in giant props, and a judge quickly ruled ST3 was constitutional, but not before saying from the bench that this case was likely above her pay grade. Ard didn't appeal right away, but says he's filed with the State Court of Appeals now because he believes the case is stronger.
The case is just really strong and has gotten stronger. The Supreme Court has spoken again on this topic of how the legislature has to draft amendatory bills. That was in the charter schools case that came down in October after our summary judgment hearing. They really emphasized the importance of this section of the Constitution. And we think if you look at that case and all the other cases that the Supreme Court has taken, the legislature really fell well outside the lines when they drafted and passed this statute.
As for what happens, should he win?
The legislation would fall, and that would mean that Sound Transit lacked the authorization to collect the 0.8% ST3 motor vehicle excise tax. They'd have to refund what they'd collected to date and would have to stop collecting it going forward.
No comment yet from Sound Transit.
And of course, if that happened, it would change the project substantially. So, Hannah, is there a feeling in the legislature, or do you know, that Sound Transit is out of control and regardless of the consequences, it needs to be canceled or pulled back?
Well, that would completely depend on who you asked. I can tell you several lawmakers, I know most predominantly Republican Senator Steve O'Bannon, who would absolutely say that sound transit is out of control. He's introduced a bill to do away with ST3, do away with the sound transit board, or make them directly elected and things of that nature. And he's got some support there. But on the other side, you've got Democrats who absolutely are deny the argument that O'Bannon would make, that ST3 sound transit that duped voters, misled voters, and the legislature in putting together that package that went to voters to authorize the $54 billion package that brought all the high car tab fees. Most in the legislature I talked to say that they knew what they were voting on, but there again are a handful that don't. So remains to be seen. There's a slew of bills against car tabs and sound transit working their way through the legislature this session. Unclear how much they will get they'd be able to get through with Democrats in control. But this is a significant lawsuit, and it's complicated and it's technical, and it's expected to play out at the state Supreme Court level in the end. But if it were to win in the end, it would completely undo everything that was in ST3.
Right. And what it would essentially mean let me ask you this. Is there a sense in the legislature that Seattle is big enough and needs to stop growing?
Well, I don't. With transit, do you mean?
It's a rhetorical question. I mean, the everybody knows there's no more place to put highways. I saw the poll in the Seattle Times over the weekend indicating that at least in Seattle and King County, public transit is the preferred option to building more highway. I don't think there's much choice about it. I mean, nobody's going to blast another Bertha through downtown Seattle. So, I mean, it sounds like the choice to me is whether you want a place to put the extra commuters or not, whether or not it relieves highway congestion. And that's why I'm asking whether there's a sense that sound transit needs to be killed at all costs. I think that would probably be a dumb idea, given that Seattle and King County provides the lion's share of revenue to finance the rest of the state, don't you think?
Well, and I think this is not necessarily an argument, this particular case, about transit. It's an argument about the way that the car tab fees were done. So what would happen if this were to go through? And I mean, I'm sure this would play out in courts for a long time, but they would have to go back to the legislature and start it over and send that package again, which of course would delay all those projects. But no, you're absolutely right. There are no other options, and there absolutely has to be transit through King County at the very least. But I think depending on who you talk to, also in Pierce and Snohomish counties, perhaps throughout the state.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pearson's almost don't want to participate in the growth. Like, you know, that's their business. But I think what would happen in that case is there'd be a delay in the project. Costs would go even higher because land prices are only going up. And you'd end up having the project only 10 years later and, 50% more expensive. Hannah Scott reporting for us this morning. Thank you, Hannah.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Do-it-yourself home renovation is all the rage these days. So you've got all the shows on HGTV, Chip and Joanna Gaines. They're the big popular couple ripping up homes and rebuilding them. So imagine ripping up the floors of your home to start fresh, and you'll find a big bag of cash.
We looked through it. It's 20s and 50s. I would say $30,000, maybe more.
$30,000. Wow. Now, mice had gotten to it, so had some mold, but it was clearly a heap of cash.
It's all greenbacks.
All greenbacks. So what do you do? Andy Rasmussen didn't hesitate. Fox 9 in Bloomington, Minnesota, says he was working a job at the time when he found the money. He was hired as a contractor by a nonprofit that fixes up homes for the physically or developmentally disabled. Nobody was around. He could have kept the money, but no. He would give it to the nonprofit that hired him for the job. He just wonders who left it there.
When we opened up the floor, there's a heat duct that was run under the floor. And so someone previously must have gone into the utility room and thrown that money up on top of that duct. Pretty crazy. It's hard to even process that amount of cash just laying around that no one knew existed. Well, someone knew, but forgot about.
It will not be forgotten this time. Now that $30,000 will go to a good cause.
Wow. Do you know how old the money was, did you say?
I mean, it looked pretty old. He was in sort of a rancher-style home, so it could have been 40s, 50s, 60s. And actually, because you think, gosh, mice, mold, how is that money even usable? There's a branch of the U.S. government, as right. I learned on CBS Sunday, which is still one of my favorite shows, where there are people who will sift through your cash. They will piece it together like a puzzle, even if it got burned in a fire, and then give you new money.
Fresh bills?
Yeah.
Right. It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Super Bowl is set, and direct from 710 ESPN, here is Danny O'Neill. First of all, that was definitely a blown pass interference call in the Saints game, right?
Yes, it was. It was probably one of the more egregious that you'll see. In fact, I think it was so egregious, that's the reason it wasn't called.
Really? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that they usually look for hand fighting. They usually look for a guy that's sort of keeping the receiver from raising his arms or making contact before it was there. And this was one where he flat out clocked the guy before the ball got there. And it looked different than you usually see pass interference calls. And they didn't flag it. They completely missed it. And honestly, if they didn't call pass interference, they probably should have called the defender for a hit to the head of a defenseless receiver.
Defenseless receiver, yeah.
It was, they missed two.
Is there some kind of rule, though, that you don't want to call something that might win the game? I mean, obviously it lost the game in this case, but is there some kind of rule about that?
Generally, officials will tend to let players play. That's what people say.
Yeah.
Let the players decide it, that they don't want an officiating decision to decide it. That's kind of a misnomer, though, because if you stop calling penalties, then you're basically helping decide the game by not calling right. those penalties. Generally, no official wants to be the central story. So I think there is an inclination over the last couple minutes of a close game where officials don't necessarily want to make that if they're going to err, they're going to err on the side of not blowing their whistle. But they're certainly not instructed, hey, let the players sort it out.
Yeah. By the way, how many times has it happened that both playoff games went to overtime?
Never. That's the first time both championship games have gone to overtime. It's only the second time that an AFC championship, and they've been playing that for more than 50 years, it's only the second time the AFC championship has gone to overtime. The first time was in 1986. So it's never happened that both games go to overtime.
That's wild. I continue to marvel at how amazingly the NFL has achieved parity, except, of course, in the case of the New England Patriots. That was also a pretty incredible game. And so who do you think, I mean, was it just a matter of when the clock ran out on that one? Was it like, you know, like basketball?
Well, I'll say this. No, the Patriots gave themselves the lead. And the fact that they kept the Chiefs scoreless for the first half, kept them from reaching the end zone and scoring a touchdown, was a huge and important, I mean, that decided the game in a lot of ways because the Chiefs played really well in the second half. But the fact that they were down 14 meant that they were basically fortunate to get it into overtime. I was surprised that Kansas City wasn't a little more aggressive on their final possession. They only took one shot at the end zone and it wasn't that aggressive of a play. That said, the Patriots were playing for that and hey, only a touchdown can beat us. But, it was a great game and Tom Brady deserves a ton of credit. He kind of got bailed out on an offsides call on what would have been a game losing interception. And after that, he was fantastic.
Yeah, I thought both games were, it was really, really fun to watch. Now, here's the question that kept bubbling up in my mind. Could the Seahawks have beat any of those teams?
Yeah, yes. They showed that this year, that they could play with absolutely any team that was in the league. They played the Rams twice. And one time the Rams needed a fourth down conversion to run out the clock. The other time the Seahawks got the ball within striking distance of the end zone but couldn't punch it in. So, yes, absolutely, the Seahawks could have beat either of these teams.
So now it's set up, and who do you root for in the Super Bowl, Danny?
Anybody but the Patriots.
Anybody but the Patriots. You're going to stick with that?
Yeah, no one wants to see the Patriots win. I'd rather see the team that's in Seattle's division win it than watch the Patriots win yet another Super Bowl. That area has been so spoiled for championships, both basketball, football, baseball. It's obnoxious. It's the worst. They deserve to lose for at least two generations after this.
But I mean, witnessing history, the dynasty aspect, that doesn't stir any emotion in you?
No, it's witnessing someone else's history And it's witnessing the emboldening of the world's most obnoxious fan base outside of New York.
So it's the fans, it's the New England fans that you hate.
No, no, I don't like seeing other people happy, Dave. I don't like seeing the happiness of people that's not me.
Well, then you, but then you can't root for either team.
Well, no, I root for whoever I want to be more miserable. I want the Patriots fans to be more miserable, so it's not even close. Hmm. Plus, I want a little rain to fall into Tom Brady's life. When's that guy going to catch a break, right? 5 Super Bowl titles, married to a supermodel. Life's so tough for him. He could take an L.
Okay. I don't know. The way I look at it now, you know, as I get older, when somebody who's that old continues to excel at any sport, I have to admire him.
That's a very fair point, Dave. And if I was a nicer, more well-rounded person, I might adopt that. Instead, I just want him to suffer.
Sports Insider Danny O'Neill. Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.